Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media here in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Obesity has reached epidemic proportion in all Western society. Evidence continues to accumulate that it's a major risk factor for many diseases and clearly associated with significant morbidity and mortality. Today's guests are Anchorage bariatric surgeons, Dr. Justin Clark and Dr. Sean Lee. We're going to discuss the indication and surgical options for obesity. This is known as bariatric surgery, so if you hear me using that term, that's what it means. And time permitting, we also will kind of get into indications and surgical options for gastroesophageal reflux disease. But the primary emphasis today is obesity and surgical options for that. Both Dr. Clark and Dr. Lee work together at Anchorage Bariatrics. Both also receive fellowship training in bariatric and minimally invasive surgery at Duke University Medical Center. And then Dr. Clark is also currently director of metabolic and bariatric surgery at Providence Alaska Medical Center. Dr. Clark, welcome back. Dr. Lee, welcome. It's nice to have both of you here.
It's a pleasure to be back, Thad. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So I don't remember. It's a couple years maybe since you were here before. We talked about obesity. What I'd like to do today is generally go over some facts about obesity, not spend a lot of time so we can spend a little bit more time on the surgery. That's both for you and for both our listeners. But let's start with some basics. What do we mean by obesity? How do we define obesity? How accurately is that defined? How many people are obese? What's happening over time? All the epidemiology.
Sure. I'll start with that one. Obesity, the way that we define it really is not perfect, but the best way that we have right now is with the body mass index. And that is kind of a ratio of your height and your weight. There's a lot of calculators out there online. There's one on our website as well, where you can figure out what your body mass index is. What the general calculation is a normal body mass index is anywhere from about 18 to 25. From 25 to 30, you're considered overweight. Once we get above 30, we're looking into the obese category. There's class 1 and class 2 obesity. And finally, once your body mass index gets above about 40, we're talking about morbid obesity. And I'll hand it to Dr. Lee to talk about the other part there.
Well, again, I didn't get a chance earlier, so thank you very much for inviting me to the show today. So I did want to mention one thing, that term morbid obesity. It's one of these medical terms, I think, that often has been sort of taken over in society as almost an insult.
Yeah, and it's got a bad connotation.
It's got a bad connotation. So people really don't like
we don't hear
that they have that term. So sometimes we'll use the term class 3 obesity, but that morbid comes down to the comorbidities. So it's not just a weight issue. It's those comorbidity is a medical term meaning diseases that come along with another disease. So obesity is the disease. The comorbidities are things like high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, sleep apnea, and the many other things that can come along with it. So that's where that comes from. So just to give a little bit of background so people understand what that term is and why we still sometimes use it.
So, the comorbidity issue is really, I guess, one of the primary reasons why you guys are involved in what you're doing and why you hear so much about obesity is all the costs associated with it. And you didn't mention knee problems and hip problems and back problems and falls.
pretty much every organ system of the body is affected. Uh-huh. You know, increased heart attack, increased stroke rate, increased kidney failure rates, liver problems. That's one of the big new ones that we're learning more and more about is fatty liver disease and how prevalent it is. So, you know, when you look at the United States population, this is a almost universal problem across the country. Over 36% of Americans are now defined as obese by those BMI criteria. Over 2/3 of Americans are considered overweight and or obese. And even, there are a variety of numbers we can look at in children across the United States. But we were looking at one publication from the state of Alaska earlier today that said maybe as many as a third of 3-year-olds are obese in the state of Alaska. Again, there are different numbers out there, and they're calculated by different measures. But certainly obesity rates in youth range between about 10 and 17 to 20%. So it's a problem that's not going away anytime soon either.
Let me take one quick second, remind everybody how you get in touch with us. We're talking about obesity, primarily the surgery options for obesity. If you've got questions or comments, our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. We have an email address, which is line1, spell it out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@alaskapublic.org. And if you need a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. So how'd we get to this problem? What are the theories about first the U.S., I think, and then most of Western countries have followed right in suit? What are the reasons for that?
You know, I wish I had a great answer for that, Thad. But if we look back about 30 years, it's about, 1991 was when many of the guidelines for bariatric surgery initially came out with the Institute of Health. But obesity was a much less problem there. I mean, even in the last 30 years, it's just really gotten out of control in the United States especially. And a lot of it, there's a lot of different reasons behind it. In particular, I would suggest it has a lot to do with the food that's produced in our country. That it's been the nutritional and chemical contents of the food have been altered. Another thing that contributes to it a lot is other medications. There's a lot of different medications, particularly for mental illness and depression, that lead to a lot of weight gain. And then you take all of that combined with stress, with lack of sleep, and you can completely change the metabolic component of someone's system. And I think that's really where we're moving with bariatric surgery, is that it's a lot of things combined that change something called the set point in the brain to alter your energy stores or your weight. And we'll talk about that more in a little bit. But I think that's the best answer I can give you there, is it's very complicated issue, but those are the big things in my mind.
Yeah, and there's definitely no one thing that causes obesity, and it's probably different in every person, from genetics to environmental circumstances to, what food is available to, how sedentary life has become. Most of us drive cars to get to where we need to go. We have water that runs out of the faucet. We have food that we just pick up at the grocery store. There's not a whole lot of work, physical work, that a lot of us do in order to feed, house, and clothe ourselves anymore in this society. So those things are all together coming to bear on this problem.
Yeah, there's been a huge change in the United States environment in the last 100 years. I mean, people used to, for the most of us, lived on farms. Now, very, very, very small percentage. Food has become much more plentiful. The caloric density of the foods we eat has come much more, and we've become much more sedentary. We don't go outside. We see vitamin D deficiency people who live in Arizona because they don't go outside. Well, we're sitting in front of computers. We don't ride bicycles as much.
Exactly.
So I like to think of it, and you guys correct me, it's an energy balance still. It's still thermodynamics. We're putting in lots more energy than we're burning off, and as a consequence, we're going to gain weight. And
right.
That's despite I'm jumping ahead, but you hear some stuff now that calories aren't calories, and your microbiome has an effect and all this, and say, I'll buy that. Maybe we each metabolize things a little differently. It's still there's a basic law of thermodynamics that comes into play here.
Yeah, conservation of energy is still applicable.
Yeah.
True.
It becomes kind of a dodge to the fact that maybe it's what I eat. It is what you eat. It's how much of what you eat.
But it is. That's an important concept, is the energy balance equation. But I think what gets lost in that is over time, that equation can change for some people.
Mm-hmm.
And so for someone who becomes obese, that calculation doesn't work so well.
Mm.
It works great before that,
mm-hmm.
or it's involved. But Once that set point has kind of changed, then your body adjusts to a new energy balance equation. And so actually it slows down your metabolism and it can increase your cravings to try to maintain you at a weight right. that's not
right.
healthy.
Right.
And that's part of the metabolic changes that we see.
There's two points there. There's the amount of calories you're taking into your mouth. There's the amount of calories that are getting absorbed into your
right.
body, and
right.
your gut microflora, or your right. biome may have something to do with that. There's probably a lot of things, you know, motility issues, medications that may bar or interfere with absorption, and a lot of that's not well defined at this point. And so those changes can be affected by the body's overall physiologic state, and when that set point changes, even though you're eating a certain number of calories, the absorption may change, and certainly the way the body utilizes the calories it absorbs can change as well.
And one more big factor that I think is worthwhile, and there may be more, but one more I like to think, is that the first big study on adverse childhood experiences came out of research on an obesity clinic where they looked at the past stress early in life in families. And so anxiety, stress, monotony, all of these things that have maybe increased along with Western society and its changes also drive some of us to have behaviors that get lead us to eat more. It's a little bit like the opioid problem. I want to be careful here. I'm making direct relationships. But we do things to make ourselves feel good when we're not feeling good. And mm-hmm. food is one of those things.
It's a big issue. I think one of the things that illustrated that for me early on in our training, something that we learned at Duke, was there was a study published that looked at the lifetime health and weight of children who were born to mothers before a bariatric surgery and after bariatric surgery. So it was mothers who had children before surgery and then who had children after surgery. And the children who were born after surgery were lifelong healthier than the children, than the brothers and sisters born before that mother had surgery. And a lot of it had to do, in my opinion, with the habits that were learned by the child were completely different.
Yeah, we've talked about this on the program a number of times. I'm going to say it again because it's so important for people to hear. What kids learn early in life has been very profoundly related to long-term experiences. So those first couple of years of life in particular, and what they eat, what they feel like with exercise, how they see people interact, is changing our brain and how we think, whether you know it or not. And the easiest way to think about that is our brain is a great learning organ. We learn very quickly and very appropriately, but it doesn't unlearn. So you can't tell me how to unlearn how to ride a bike anymore. You can tell me how to unlearn those early childhood experiences. So that, I think, gets back to what you were saying, and yet I wanted to kind of knee-jerk in or a little thing in there about pediatrics and the early exposure to all kinds of things in childhood and how it can affect lifelong outcomes. Let me mention one more time that we're talking about bariatric surgery, surgery for obesity. We're just kind of briefly talking about how we got to the point where we need to talk about this kind of thing, and then we're going to get into the surgical options. If you've got questions or comments, our local number 550-8433, toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and an email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Let's one more time mention the major significant complications of being overweight, and maybe, I hate to throw in another one, some people say, well, if I exercise and I'm overweight, is that going to make a difference from these complications we're talking about? I'm thinking about what people are thinking out there, what might be easier to do rather than lose weight.
Well, exercise is never a bad thing. You know, you always want to do that in a smart way. You know, if you have joint problems, if you have physical limitations, if you've had heart disease, you know, it's not a good idea to go out and jump on a treadmill and try to overexert yourself. But exercise that's done in a planned way, and especially with your physician's approval, is always a good thing. And for a lot of our patients who are overweight and obese, you know, it's important to think about the impact that exercise is going to have on the joints. And so sometimes walking, running is not the best exercise for them, but they can certainly get in a pool. They can use a stationary bicycle, a regular bicycle. You know, there's yoga, there's Pilates, there's a ton of things that they can go out and do. And so that is always a good thing. The other side of that, when you look at weight loss, is there have, and kind of dovetailing this back into why surgery, is that there has been no large-scale study of a diet and or exercise program that, when looked at over a period of years and follow-up, has ever led to any significant weight loss. So the studies published in the Journal of the American Medical Association looked at several major kind of name brand almost weight loss programs. And over a year or so, you know, your average weight loss is in the 7 to 10 pound range for some of those big name diets. And when you go and look out 3, 4, 5 years, the average weight loss of a group of people doing an intervention, whether it be diet, exercise, or both, is negative. Yeah, and the pattern generally is, and most of our patients have experienced this, where they work really, really hard, lose the weight, and to some extent kind of fall off that exercise and diet wagon, and slowly the weight comes back on plus more. So it's not that it's impossible, because there's about 3 to 5% of folks in the different studies that are able to keep that weight loss off long term, but it's very, very difficult.
I think this is an excellent point. So what I'm hearing you say, and I agree with, is that if we critically look at all the non-surgical attempts to get people to lose weight, there is some success in the short term for a certain percentage of patients. But if we look long term, it doesn't matter how popular that diet is, how many books about that diet have been sold, over a long term, people end up back where they were, with very few exceptions. There is a small percentage, less than 5%, that maintain that over a period of time. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And mm-hmm. I think
it's not how popular, it's not who says it. It doesn't make any difference.
No.
Medically, we haven't figured out a way to consistently get people to lose weight.
That's exactly right. And the numbers specifically is, if you take people who are already obese and you put them on a dedicated diet and exercise plan, after 5 years, only 2 to 5% will have lost a significant amount of weight and maintain that weight. So 95% plus fail mm-hmm. with that alone. And where we can add in surgery, we can get an 85% success rate. So numbers
at five years.
Yeah.
So significantly better.
Right.
Head to head. Looks at these things.
Exactly.
We haven't talked about side effects yet, but
no,
outcomes.
No. Yeah. And I want to make the point that it's not just surgery. Okay. Right. That is surgery in combination specifically with dietary change, with exercise, behavioral change, all of those things. So it's not in isolation. You have to do it together, but the success rate is much, much bigger.
And let me go back 1 second, because I think we all would agree with this, but it's important to be said that this failure to lose weight for these individuals, it's not a reflection of laziness. It's not a reflection of lack of intelligence. You know, I think we all know people who are extremely intelligent. I mean, I think one of the most impressive resumes I've ever seen was by somebody who was morbidly obese. And that's actually been studied. There have been sociologic studies looking at, you know, work habits, and, you know, it's not a laziness thing. There's definitely physiologic and probably some psychological things in there for some people as well, but there's a lot of physiology, genetics, environmental, cultural things that are affecting these folks, and they've tried many, many, many times, and it's just very, very difficult to do.
Yeah. And I wanted to address, Thad, your comment about the comorbidities, because the big ones that we talk about in obesity are going to be high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, and obstructive sleep apnea. Those are kind of the big four, and those are the ones that the insurance companies care most about. When we expand that, obviously, we talked about it affects every system in the body. So we're talking about headaches, joint-related issues, and specifically a big one for me is cancer. So there are higher documented rates of breast cancer, colon cancer, pancreas cancer, in obese patients. And so that's one thing that we do to try to reduce someone's risk is to help them lose weight.
We just keep bringing up ideas, and when you talk about cancer and so forth, that made me jump to the idea that, and I want you guys to correct me to see if things have evolved since this, but I think of currently that obesity is an inflammatory, pro-inflammatory state, which is increases inflammation, which is one of the theories behind why cancer may be increased. Is what am I talking about, and is that still felt to be a significant issue?
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely true that obesity is pro-inflammatory, and there's probably some degree of local damage on in a variety of organ systems with obesity. You know, as we mentioned earlier, liver, fatty liver disease and liver cancer is higher in the obese population, and that's kind of one example. Fat cells or adipocytes are not simply sitting there adding weight to the body and storing fat. There is a ton of metabolic activity and hormones that are being secreted by those cells and doing things, not just for obesity, but they're affecting how the blood vessels around them manage fat floating through them and development of lipid streaks and atherosclerotic disease. They are affecting how muscle cells are sensitive around them are sensitive or not to insulin. So the metabolic effects are profound and I think in a lot of instances are not well understood.
And estrogen as well. I'll point out estrogen is a lot of times increased with fat, and so it puts women at increased risk of breast cancer.
That's a good point.
That's good.
One more argument, Dr. Clark and Dr. Lee. How come, if obesity is such a bad thing, we're living longer than we've ever lived? how do you answer that one?
Well, I don't know. I'd question you if that to look at, see who exactly is living longer, because it may not be the obese people that are living longer. But in general, you're correct. We are living longer, and the quality of our healthcare in general has drastically improved in every level. The quality of our ICU care, medicines that are used to mask and treat all the problems that we never used to have.
So we're getting better and better at treating cardiovascular disease, prevention it with some drugs, for example.
We're getting better
and
at treating
cancer
everything.
Is becoming more of a chronic disease.
Right.
So we're living longer, but the quality of life may not be so good.
May not be, right. Yeah. And I think that's what Dr. Lee and I both love about weight loss surgery and bariatric surgery is the ability to alter the course of someone's life, get them off of these medications, prolong their life, but out of the most important thing that I say that we can do is improve the quality of somebody's life. That's our primary goal here.
And there is some data out there saying just recently that life expectancy may actually plateau here, and we may have a generation upcoming that lives shorter than their parents' generation. I'm not sure that that's conclusive yet, but I think I think you look at the way we treat disease in so many ways and dimensions.
Yeah, so the past does not necessarily predict the future.
Not necessarily.
And many of us who are reaching these older ages grew up in the late 40s and 50s when we just take a picture, look at a photograph of kids in the 50s. They don't look like the kids in the 2000s as far as size. And so maybe, as we talked about, early exposures can have a lot to do with late outcomes. And we just haven't gotten there yet that things are going to slow down and not look so pretty. Okay. Let me remind listeners one more time. We're talking with Dr. Justin Clark and Dr. Sean Lee. Both are bariatric surgeons here in Anchorage. And we're trying to talk about, or we're getting to, surgery. We've already mentioned some of the reasons why surgical options for obesity might be important. If you've got questions or comment, our local number, 550-8433, toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. I have one email already. I'm going to hold off because the question, I think, will be better answered once we get into some of the surgical options. Before we start talking about surgical options, somebody take me through the anatomy, the basic anatomy of the gastrointestinal tract in particular, maybe a little bit about physiology, what happens in that GI tract that's related to obesity.
Sure. So in the simplest form, we put food into our mouth. It's somewhat macerated there with our chewing mechanism. It goes down our throat to our esophagus. where it then passes into our stomach, and there's a valve there called the lower esophageal sphincter that helps things not go back up the esophagus. Food is partially digested in the stomach, and then it's gone into our small intestine, which has three parts, the duodenum, the jejunum, and the ileum, and finally into our colon, where a lot of the water is taken out of the food there. But that's the most general form, and what we're doing with bariatric surgery, and I'll let Dr. Lee explain some of that, is we're altering one or two portions of this process to change the hormones and metabolism of the gut.
Okay. So, yeah, what are we doing? That's a good, in some levels, that's a very good question. We still don't have full understanding of how the surgery itself affects the weight loss changes and the changes in the comorbidities. But if we take the sleeve gastrectomy, we are dividing the stomach longitudinally. And so what that means is instead of being a large sack shape, it changes the shape into sort of a narrow banana, kind of a curved tube. And the part of the stomach is taken out of the body. Now that's gone. That part of the stomach, we know, does a few things. And one of those things is it's the main storage portion of the stomach. So people can't eat as much at one time. And that's termed a restriction. I think we do all generally agree that that's part of it. But probably more pronounced is that there is a effect on hormone levels and GI tract hormones, and one in particular called ghrelin. And when I'm discussing this with patients, I kind of talk about GI hormones that affect appetite control as sort of the fullness or the hunger hormones, because we have hormones that are shown to be do one or the other. And some in some circumstances are one way, and in other circumstances are a different way. So it's a very complex system. But one of the main hunger hormones is ghrelin, and that lives generally in the upper portion of the stomach. And the vast majority of the cells that secrete that hormone are taken out when we do a sleeve gastrectomy. So if we do blood testing before and after surgery, we can see that the levels drop precipitously almost immediately after surgery. So in most of our patients, the appetite level drops as well, corresponding to, we think, to those hormone levels. The gastric bypass is a little more complex conceptually. I can take a stab at it here on the radio. It's really nice to have visuals, and I would
not the right media for this.
I would point people to the website, and our website at Anchorage Bariatrics will have some videos and pictures and things. But we're cutting a small portion of the upper stomach, the part that's attached to the esophagus, away from the rest of the stomach. And then we're sewing that directly to the middle of the intestine, therefore bypassing the stomach and the upper intestine. What that does is it seems to increase your fullness hormones. So same effect, but by kind of an opposite mechanism, whereas the sleeve decreases your hunger hormone more significantly, the bypass increases fullness hormones. And that hunger hormone level doesn't drop nearly as much. But the effect is still similar. You develop restriction because you have a much smaller stomach that sees the food, and you have a decrease in appetite hormone.
Right, and there's a malabsorptive component to the bypass as well. So you're bypassing some of the intestine, probably about 25% or so, that the food isn't seeing, or that the that's not getting digested essentially, and so. You can have so less of the food that you're eating is getting absorbed, and so we used to think that with the sleeve and the bypass, that restricting how much you could eat and malabsorbing the food was the primary mechanism of how these lost weight. And I think over the last 5 to 10 years, the research has really proven that it's probably the change in hormones that's the biggest driver of the weight loss, and then resetting that set point. And so hitting that reset button to get your body to regulate to a new lower level.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's data to look at that malabsorptive issue, because it was really what we were hanging our hats on as being the thing that led to weight loss after the surgery, 10, mm-hmm. 20 years ago. And it may not actually play that major a role in the absorption of calories. Certainly, there are certain vitamins that are absorbed in the upper GI tract that has a bigger impact on absorption of those vitamins. But for calories, you know, we know we can remove in most people up to 2/3 of the GI of the small intestine, and they will absorb okay. It will affect their absorption, but they'll absorb okay, well enough to continue on and be able to eat normally and maintain a normal weight. So how profound is this effect of bypassing some of that intestine on the absorption of calories, so like proteins, sugars, and fats in the food? It's still sort of up in the air, but definitely much more of the focus, like Dr. Clark just mentioned, is on these hormone levels and appetite.
So beginning in your, let me recap again for people that are listening, where the actually digestion probably actually starts in the mouth with saliva, and then it proceeds in the stomach, and it's digested. And then the small intestine, that large amount of intestine we have, is where a lot of absorption of the digested products happen, including vitamins and minerals, as well as fats, carbohydrates, and protein, the major components of food. And then everything left over goes into the colon, water gets reabsorbed, we store that stuff and poop it out.
That's right.
That's basically what happens. So when we start messing around with the anatomy, we may pay a price. And what we've in absorption, we got to be careful about. But we also have learned that there's some hormones, there's some gut-brain interactions going on down there. And what hormones do is they usually have a feedback mechanism. So you remove that ghrelin stuff, which is your appetite. And my first thought is, my brain's going to start saying, you better get hungry because you're not getting that message that we're full, or vice versa. So there's this, that can be an issue. But it looks like, and I guess what part of the stomach you remove has to do whether this the hungry or I'm full hormones are removed.
That's right.
Is that right? They're
exactly.
Anatomically.
That's right.
Different places within the stomach.
That's right.
Yep, that's a good summary.
You know, and that's in one way we think about it. Just, there's this term that the intestinal break. Mm-hmm. So if it kind of makes sense, you know, if you're eating and your body wants to tell you when you're full, when food starts getting through the stomach into the intestine, the body has mechanisms to say, hey, you've eaten enough. Stop. You're full. The bypass, by kind of sewing that intestine straight up to the stomach, that those mechanisms, those brakes, start getting put on much earlier. And that's mm-hmm. those fullness hormones are then being released into the body and saying, hey, you're full, stop eating. And so the appetite levels tend to drop, and the amount you want to eat at a time drops with as well.
So the logical, I don't have as much stomach, I can't, that's not what's going on. There's much more complex hormonal issues that
exactly.
are going on.
Yeah. I mean, it is obviously a component, yeah. especially early on after surgery is relearning mm-hmm. and relearning your limits, but it's probably not the primary mechanism anymore.
All right. We need to take a 1 minute break here, everybody. We have an email, a couple of phone calls. I'll get right to you when we get back. But I want to remind everybody you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. Our local number, again, 550-8433. Toll free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, lineone@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short 1 minute break, and then we'll continue our discussion of surgical options for obesity with Dr. Justin Clark and Dr. Sean Lee of Anchorage. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection. We're originating from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're discussing the indications and surgical options for surgery that address obesity. This is known as bariatric surgery. Ideally we'd have a little bit of time to talk about gastroesophageal reflux disease. I don't think that's going to happen. We will mention it perhaps as complications of surgery, however. My guests are Anchorage bariatric surgeons, Dr. Justin Clark and Dr. Sean Lee. Both received their fellowship training in bariatric surgery and minimally invasive surgery at Duke University Medical Center. You can mail your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And remember, you can always listen to this program by going to alaskapublic.org, find the Line 1 link, and you can find our archives. Also, this program will repeat between 8 and 9 tonight on 91.1 FM, but we will not be able to answer questions. I'm going to go ahead and try to take some phone calls now. The first one we have is Jim, who is in Eagle River. Jim, you got some questions for me?
Yeah, let me start with just one. Several years ago, I heard about a procedure that had been okayed in Europe, but not yet in the U.S. It involved swallowing a balloon that was then inserted with saline, and after 3 or 4 months, the balloon would dissolve, and there you would be. And at the time, it seemed like a very reasonable procedure that resulted in significant weight loss, and I wonder what your opinion and the status of that procedure is now.
Yeah, what happened to that one? Okay, who wants to handle that?
Jim it was, right?
Right.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Jim. So the balloon that you swallow is not an FDA-approved device in the U.S. currently. There are, however, two FDA-approved balloon devices on the market. One is called the Orbera intragastric balloon. The other is called the ReShape. Dr. Lee and I both performed the Orbera intragastric balloon here in Alaska. We're the only two surgeons who do that. And we use it as part of our practice for the right patient. The balloon is a great idea in conception. The ones that you swallow and dissolve are still being developed. I believe one of them is called the Obalon device. And that may have just become FDA approved, but I don't know of anyone doing that device just yet. So your question is a good one, that we are always looking for non-surgical options to treat weight. And I think that's where why we do the Orbera, is to give our patients an option that doesn't include surgery, but gives a procedural option to give them that jump start. You know, and the results from that can vary. Be happy to talk more about that at a later date. But in actuality, the big difference between the Orbera or a balloon and the surgical options is that you're not changing the anatomy. And so for some people, that's a good thing. But in otherwise, we think of the hormone and the anatomy changes as the driving factor in weight loss, and we're not getting that with the balloon. So there's pluses and minuses.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
All right, Jim, thanks for the call. Janet, you're on line one.
Hi. My question is, since we're learning the influence of hormones on obesity, what is the possibility of developing hormones as a medication versus surgery?
Very good question.
Well, Janet, yes, thank you for the question. I think, it does seem like it would make sense. You know, if these hormone levels are affecting your hunger, why can't we recapitulate that effect with a medication? And I think the best answer for that is it's just difficult to do. There have been several attempts at recapitulating that effect with different chemicals. And so if you, and hormones themselves, when you talk in terms of a medication. It has to be something that can be put into a pill and survive on the shelf for a while, or be put into an injectable, and how long that's going to survive and how it's going to get absorbed. So that's part of the issue. The other part of the problem with taking those single hormones and making them into a medication is that these systems are very, very complex. And so we use the terms, you know, ghrelin or fancy, one of the other fullness hormones, GLP-1. We know that these play a major role, but it's likely that there are several other things going on at the same time in the background that we may not clearly understand. So, you know, pharmaceutical companies have learned this lesson the hard way, that taking one hormone and injecting that into the body may have very little effect, because in the background there may be a dozen different hormonal systems all working in concert to have an effect. And I think one of the most dramatic examples of that was with sepsis and trauma, when they were looking at a specific hormone like TNF-alpha or IL-1 blocking agents. If you could block that one hormone, it just didn't do enough to stop the cascade of effects. And I think we'd run into that similar situation with the weight issues. And so we're really, not aware of anything really in the pipeline for hormone-based therapy for weight.
Yeah, there's really no magic pill, unfortunately. There is a GLP-1, Byetta, that is developed off of that hormone principle. Mm-hmm. It's a diabetic medication. It also leads to a slight amount of weight loss. So it has been done. But just as Dr. Lee said, there's so many different pieces of the puzzle. You can't take one and expect the whole thing to change.
Yeah, so Janet, what I'm hearing people say is, yeah, we know a lot about some of the major hormones in the body and medications that block the effects of those or replace them and so forth. But at this time, the complexity of this appetite suppressive, metabolic milieu is not gotten to the point where the answer seems to be medically appropriate yet. Is that
Kind of summarize that
issue.
Yeah.
That help you, Janet?
Yeah, it does. But then I think,
I'm sorry, did you cut off? You were going to make another comment? I'd say thanks. I couldn't hear that. All right, I think she's gone. Thank you very much. I've got an email that came in very early. This is a person who had VSG surgery. You guys are going to have to help me on that. In 2013, so about 4 years ago, lost 70 pounds, regained some of it. His issue is heartburn is still a daily issue for me. So I'd like to ask the question, although he doesn't, how much is heartburn a complication of or a long-term problem of this particular surgery? But he has to take an antacid every day. He's worried about the long-term side effects of that medication. I've heard that bone loss is an issue, he says, which he's correct on. But we might want to comment. So those are his questions. And he also said, please emphasize the importance of having to remain on top of this issue, which, Dr. Clark, I think you've addressed already. The surgery by itself is not necessarily the end point for this problem.
Yeah, maybe I could start with that one, and then we'll have Sean, maybe Dr. Lee, excuse me, talk maybe about how we deal with the problem of it. But
Okay. You can call me Sean.
We've known each other a long time. The VSG is referring to the vertical sleeve gastrectomy or the sleeve gastrectomy. They're both interchangeable. When I discuss options with people, and what we do is we have people come in the office, watch different videos on the different surgeries and all of the stuff we're talking about today to help educate them before the surgery. But what I tell people is that each of the surgery has its own benefits and drawbacks. One of the drawbacks to the sleeve gastrectomy is reflux can get worse. And it's hard to put a number on that, but I'd say about 15 to 20% of people will have worsening reflux after this operation. And that's even if you didn't have reflux before the operation. So one thing we try to do to prevent this is if someone has a hiatal hernia, which is a small hernia of the stomach above the diaphragm, is we make sure we fix that at the same time as doing a sleeve gastrectomy. Also, our routine at Anchorage Bariatrics is to keep people on a acid suppression medication for 6 months after the operation, and then the goal is to get off of that And part of that isn't just for reflux, but to protect the stomach and the staple line and all the anatomy changes that we did. And you know, it's really important before Dr. Lee talks about the how we maybe treat this reflux long term, is that you have to have a good follow-up program, and you need to see a person who's adept at identifying these problems in the bariatric stomach, which is very different than a normal stomach. And so that's part of our routine, is we follow people every 3 months for the first year after surgery, and then every year for 5 years, so that we can maintain that relationship and help identify these things long term. So I'll hand it to Dr. Lee to talk about what we could do for you now.
Well, he definitely touched on a major topic, and vertical sleeve gastrectomy is the kind of formal, that's what the VSG comes from in that field. And, you know, there's experts on both sides. Oh, it can make reflux a little bit better, or it can make reflux worse. And I think the hiatal hernia issue that Dr. Clark, that Justin just mentioned before he gets me back, I think, an important one. But we've certainly had folks who do have a bit worsening reflux despite fixing the hernia and not seeing hernia recurrence after sleeves. So I don't think I fully understand exactly who will and who won't have worsening versus improvement in reflux after a sleeve. But it's something we definitely got to discuss. Now, one of the big issues there is that gastric bypass is one of the best, and probably not, if not the absolute best operation you can get for reflux. And you know, folks do really, really well from a reflux standpoint after gastric bypass. So that's why it's been a little more controversial. Well, if we have this other option that's going to do really well for the reflux, then why do the sleeve that may risk worsening their reflux? And, well, the answer is there's other issues involved in deciding between the two surgeries. But certainly when folks' reflux gets really severe after a sleeve, one of the options is to go back in and convert it to a gastric bypass. Mm-hmm. That's probably the more extreme. Some folks after a sleeve will have a hernia that hasn't been fixed or that has recurred. Unfortunately, hiatal hernia surgery is one of these kind of humbling things in surgery, that there, no matter how good a job you do, there's about a 20% or higher recurrence rate. So it may be that needs to go back in and be fixed. Medications are an option. So the proton pump inhibitor agents, the, you know, Nexium, Protonix, Prilosec, you know, that sort of, that group of agents are considered the more potent option there, but now we are learning more and more about the long-term side effects of those medications, including potential for bone loss, potential for actually renal damage over the long term in rare instances, or in very uncommon instances at least. So the question is, do you have to be on that? You could potentially also try H2 blockers such as Zantac or Pepcid that may have a little bit better long-term risk profile. Or just continue to monitor your bone health, make sure your vitamin D and your calcium levels continue to be normal, and supplement as needed. Lastly, there's actually some new things for reflux, and there are a couple of trials ongoing. I know one of our former mentors at Duke is doing a trial looking at an endoscopic anti-reflux procedure that can be done after sleeve gastrectomy, and is having some early success with that as well.
And I guess it should be mentioned that you guys educated me before the program is that obesity by itself is a risk factor for reflux. So cause and effect can get a little bit complicated here.
It can be murky.
It does. And
what's the reason for the reflux? Yeah.
Well, you know, a lot of people have a hiatal hernia or simply just increased intra-abdominal pressure. And we kind of get into, for people, one of the biggest reasons why some anti-reflux operations fail, things like the Nissen fundoplication that you may have heard of, or a stomach wrap, is that people who are obese have it done. And when we get someone with a body mass over about 35, a stomach wrap's probably not the best option for their reflux, because there's going to be a high failure rate within 2 to 3 years. And so that's when we start thinking about a bariatric operation instead of a specific reflux operation. So something like the gastric bypass that can help eliminate reflux but also lead to weight loss as well. And I would just comment briefly on one more comment on the sleeve and reflux is he's 4 years out now. One thing to consider is that he may need some increased screening with endoscopy. We know that reflux long-term, we're talking maybe 10 or 20 years, can lead to some cellular changes in the esophagus, things we call Barrett's esophagus, and it's important that that's not forgotten and that, you know, that just keep it in the back of your mind that someone needs to look at it.
Yeah, I think that is important, and my understanding is that's painful or symptomatic reflux. Some people have asymptomatic reflux and the same risk does not exist. Is that true, or am I saying something wrong here?
No, the risk still exists.
It does.
Yeah,
okay.
It absolutely does.
So if you reflux, painful or not, discomfort or not, if you persist for a long period of time, you may be having some changes in your lower esophagus, which puts you at increased risk of cancer of the esophagus.
Yeah.
So
it it's small. That's a small increased risk,
but
it is there.
Monitoring, and that's the recommended thing.
Yep.
Thank you. I missed that one on the test. Okay. So another question comes in. Is Medicare and Medicaid cover these procedures, and how long does the sleeve surgery take?
I'll take the first part there. Medicaid and Medicare do cover this operation, yes.
And I'll dovetail that in. You know, I'm just coming to Alaska in from the Georgia, South Carolina area. And, you know, Medicaid, you know, it depends on which company is servicing your Medicaid. Some do and some don't. That may be different here in Alaska, and that's something I'll have to learn up on. But Medicare, CMS generally does a pretty good job covering this these operations. How long does it take? Well, again, it depends. The average sleeve gastrectomy from where we are, the surgical part where we make the incision to where we put in the last stitch is usually in the order of 30 to 45 minutes. If we're doing something else in there, some folks will need a liver biopsy if they have fatty liver disease. That may add a few minutes to the procedure. If somebody has a significant hiatal hernia and we need to fix that, that can add about 30 or 40 minutes to the procedure in and of itself. Although, interestingly, it can be done without any further incisions. It's all done through the same incisions. It just takes a little more time.
And the final question the same listener had is, are there non-surgical options like hormone suppressing drugs? We've already addressed that. The quick answer is, yeah, there's some research going on. Nothing's being used significantly at this time that we're aware of.
Well, I sort of organize our program into three major aspects that, and we try to offer a full spectrum of weight loss options. So the non-invasive, the sort of the first part would be working with our dietitian, changing exercise habits, dietary habits, maybe adding in some weight or some appetite suppression medications. There's various ones on the market. And those are all non-surgical, you know, behavioral type options. And then we have the procedural based option, which would be the Orbera intragastric balloon, sort of a go-between. And then finally the surgical option. So really our goal is to be able to offer everyone who walks through our door an opportunity to lose weight, however it's going to work best for them.
I think that's an important thing for you guys. What I like what I'm hearing, and let me see if you guys, if I'm hearing this right. One, we haven't said it specifically, but patient selection is a big part of this. Not only is who's appropriate for surgery, but what surgery is best for that individual patient, which gets into patients' needs also. It's a two-sided coin, and we're getting more and more into that in medicine and listening to what patients want. Then you're having follow-up, which when you do a long-term follow-up, you learn what works and what doesn't work individually, and you see how things are going. And then you are also offering this behavioral approach both as an adjunct to surgery or to help prevent the need for surgery. And all this is going on in at Anchorage Bariatrics, which I think is a really nice way to do things. And I would compliment you guys for that effort.
Well, thank you. I mean, definitely, you know, the same shoe doesn't fit everybody. And there can be a variety of reasons for people deciding one type of treatment pathway versus another. And we want to be able to provide folks with the treatment that's most appropriate for them and where they're at. You know, and I guarantee we'll have folks who want to do a non-surgical option who work through that, and it may not work for them in the long term, who eventually come to surgery.
And the opposite too. We've had people who come in for surgery, and we say, "Oh, you need to lose this amount of weight before surgery to make it safer," and they do it with our help, and they say, "You know what? I'm going to keep doing this, and I'm going to see how far I can go without surgery." And we absolutely support that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So if there's an answer to the medical issue, it's somehow getting the patient motivated enough to stay with the problem, and that's true of basically all behavioral problems, addictions.
Mm-hmm. It's not
exercise. I mean, it's somewhere it's got to hit you between the eyes. I got to do this, and motivation ratchets up, and you're more likely to continue and be successful.
And it can't be a short term thing.
Yeah.
You know
that this is a lifelong.
A diet is not a short. It's for forever change.
Yeah, and I'll throw in a plug for our support groups, because that's a big thing that we try to do is for our long term follow up and success is. That we have two support groups each month. The first Wednesday of every month is a community support group at Providence Hospital. The third Wednesday of every month is a nutritional support group with our dietitian in our office. And they're both free, and they're both open to anybody.
We've only got, believe it or not, 2 minutes left, and I wanted to spend a little bit more time on the surgical options. I don't think we're going to get there. What I'd like to do is give you guys an opportunity to perhaps give your phone number. If anybody who comes to our website at alaskapublic.org will find the link to your website, but your phone number and maybe what you want people to, most important lessons or information you want to have people take away from this program. Remember, most of us are not going to remember a lot, but what are the two or three big things that you want people to have learned today?
Well, I think the big concepts are that, you know, obesity is a major problem, and it's a disease. It doesn't mean there's something wrong with that person's, you know, intellect. It's not a laziness thing. It's a disease, and it's multifactorial causes. The second, and hopefully, understanding that will allow people to kind of accept it as a disease and to seek treatment. And so, the second big area is, you know, what are the treatments out there? You know, we have behavioral interventions, you know, with the dietary changes, exercise changes, and medications. We have endoscopic treatment, so a procedural based but not involving incision type of treatment. And then we have a variety of surgical options for those who choose to go that route. And that all of those options are appropriate in different situations.
Yeah.
Your buddy took up most of your time.
That's okay.
There, Justin.
I'll give you the anchorageberiatrics.com. The number's real easy. It's 907-644-THIN, 644-8446. And you can call us or email us, and we'll get back with you.
Great program. Good information. Hopefully our listeners appreciate it as much as I did. Thanks very much to Sean Lee. Dr. Sean Lee and Dr. Justin Clark for taking the time to be with us today. Remember, you can always go to our website, alaskapublic.org, and listen to the program again by checking it out in our Line 1 archives. Next week, we're going to discuss the lifelong effects that fetal alcohol exposure can cause. And why not join us and learn more next Monday, September 28th at 2 p.m. on Alaska Public Media, FM 91.1. Dave Waldron was our day's engineer. Eric Bork is our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day. Hey, and watch what you eat out there.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.